Usually when we report on the Federal Reserve, we're talking about interest rates or inflation, but lately Fed officials have been focusing on housing. They've been out in public pushing measures they think will help the housing market. And to find out why and what they're up to, we turn, as we often do, to David Wessel. He's the Wall Street Journal's economics editor. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So the Fed, have they ever really been involved this much in housing policy before, and what exactly are they trying to do?
Well, housing has always been a big part of the Fed's portfolio because it's so important to the economy. But usually, we haven't been in circumstances like this. Fed officials basically have been saying in their speeches and in a 26-page white paper, an unusual white paper that the Fed sent to Congress, that one reason the economy isn't doing better is that housing isn't healing very fast. The president of the New York Fed, for instance, said it was difficult to achieve a vigorous economic recovery unless the ongoing weakness in housing was addressed. The president of the San Francisco Fed, a new one, John Williams, talked about a housing depression. Basically, they're saying we've done what we can to get the economy working better. It would do much better if the rest of the government paid some attention to getting the housing market going again, the mortgage machinery making going again.
Okay, so they're giving speeches. They're sending this big white paper to Congress. But are they actually discussing any firm proposals that they think Congress should take up?
Absolutely, and that's what made this interesting. They're saying that the alphabet soup of programs that the government has tried to help housing, to help homeowners, isn't doing enough, and they've come up with a list of things they think the government ought to do. They think the government ought to find a way to reduce the glut of houses for sale, because banks have taken over so many houses, so many foreclosed houses, there's just a glut of supply. They'd like to make it easier for banks and others who own these houses to rent them out, to reduce the number for sale. They think that more should be done to make sure that the regulators, the lenders, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, haven't overreacted to the crisis and are they think they're being too stingy, too picky about lenders. The Fed actually said that if mortgages had been this hard to get for the past few decades, we might be a nation of renters. And they're looking for alternatives to foreclosure. If someone's not going to be able to pay their loan and the lender's going to take it over, they'd like to speed the process so it's not so cumbersome.
Well, Congress is not exactly a place where members enjoy being told how to do their job, typically. I mean, how are they reacting to this?
Well, that's a good question, David. Really, the reaction is mixed. There are a number of economists, of Republican and Democrat, who've been talking about these things. But when the Fed puts out a list to get some attention, and Senator Orrin Hatch, a senior Republican from Utah on the Senate Finance Committee, he sent a blistering letter to Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, saying that the Fed is treading on the turf of Congress and the regulators, and ought to back off. And he said, I'm sure that the Fed wouldn't appreciate a white paper from Congress outlining how to think about monetary policy, which was kind of ironic since members of Congress and Ron Paul running for president don't seem any hesitancy to give.
They tell people how to do their jobs all the time.
Right. Some people think this is putting pressure on the regulator of Fannie and Freddie to do something more to help the housing market during an election season. The Fed says that's not so. Other people say that maybe what the Fed is doing is giving the regulator some cover here by saying, look, the Fed thinks this is a good idea. It's in the long-term interest of the taxpayer, so we ought to do something here.
All right. David Wessel is the economics editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us often to talk about the economy. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We'll be hearing throughout this hour about the shifting American economy. We've always known the economy would be a big factor in the presidential race. In the last week, the focus has sharpened as Mitt Romney, the Republican frontrunner, came under attack for his past work directing a private equity firm. Bain Capital took over other companies and restructured them, creating wealth but also eliminating jobs in some cases.
But first, what happens when a company is slow to adapt to the new global economy? It's something Rochester, New York knows all too well. Eastman Kodak once provided tens of thousands of Rochester residents with secure, good-paying jobs. Now Kodak is on the brink of bankruptcy. Julie Phillip of member station WXXI reports people there have been weathering its decline for a long time.
Kodak's long, cold winter has lasted about 25 years. That's about how long the company has been shedding local employees, from a high of more than 60,000 in 1982 to about 6,000 today. But it's still tough to find anyone in this town who doesn't have some connection to Kodak.
Many people met their spouses in the dark room or someplace in Kodak Park.
About half of Kodak's 38,000 retirees still live here. And John Lawson of Tompkins Financial Advisors says more and more of them are showing up at his office with their financial records and their memories in hand. He says this is not just a money matter for most. There are a lot of emotions involved.
I know of people that go down to where some of the buildings were imploded and stand on the grassy knolls in the parks and recall their Kodak days.
Lawson says for the most part, retirees will probably get whatever pension earnings they're entitled to today, even if Kodak declares Chapter 11 tomorrow. For some, he says, that might not be much, but that's due to lackluster investments or poor decision-making in the past. In the 1990s, Kodak offered early retirement incentive programs with big lump-sum payouts, and some people took that money and invested in their lifetime dreams.
Bought a bowling alley or a restaurant or something like that because they were in their late 40s, early 50s.
The nation's economy soured, and so did many of those endeavors. Those people have already had to adjust. That's not to say there still won't be pain for some retirees. Kent Gardner is chief economist for the Center for Governmental Research. He points to the group of about 6,000 local retirees who are a little too young for Medicare if Kodak drops retiree health care coverage. They might have to pay for private insurance for a few years, and that could impact the entire community.
Kodak retirees are going to spend less on other things. It also may, and I think this is maybe a more serious concern, it may persuade them that they really need to think about a different place to live.
A place where health insurance costs and taxes are lower. But, Lawson points out, most people who never worked for Kodak, never had retiree health care coverage or many of the other shiny perks once offered by Kodak, and they still manage to make a go of it in Rochester.
No, and in many ways, people are much better off than if they'd have never been Kodak people. But your level of expectations is built up.
And Rochester Mayor Tom Richards says the same thing about this city. It's better off having been a Kodak town. Nearly all of its major educational, cultural, and philanthropic institutions were either started by or benefited from Kodak founder George Eastman, his company, or his employees.
Those institutions are still here. They are the strength of this town. They're one of the reasons we've gotten through this as well as we have and will continue to get through it.
Richard says local Kodak suppliers have had time to adapt, and it's been years since car dealers and appliance sales reps got excited about big spending sprees on Kodak Employee Bonus Day. He says if Kodak goes bankrupt, it will be a symbolic moment, but not much more.
If Kodak goes bankrupt here in the next couple of weeks or whenever they do, you know, I'm going to get up the next morning and I'm pretty much going to have to do what I did the day before.
Richard says bankruptcy and a restructuring could be what Kodak needs to end its long winter and start looking for signs of spring. For NPR News, I'm Julie Philip.
In Indiana, Republican legislators and Governor Mitch Daniels continued their push today to make their state the 23rd right-to-work state in the country. Democrats there are working to delay the process as long as possible. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, they have few options left.
2012 isn't the first time Republicans have tried to pass right-to-work in Indiana. Last year, pushing the bill sent House Democrats fleeing to Illinois for 5 weeks, halting business in the legislature and forcing Republicans to take it off the table. This time around, Democrats have stayed in Indianapolis but off the House floor. They denied a quorum the first 3 days of session last week. Minority Leader Pat Bauer says the goal of his caucus is to buy more time for the public to study the bill.
This is such an important bill, such a controversial bill, the whole state ought to hear from it. We don't need to ram it through.
Republicans say they've done anything but. Over the summer, a legislative study committee took 20 hours of testimony on right to work, and a joint House and Senate committee spent more than 5 hours on the bill last week. Speaking at that committee meeting, Democratic Senator Jim Arnold all but conceded defeat.
I truly don't believe also that any minds or any votes are going to be changed by what was said here today.
The two sides seem entrenched. Right-to-work legislation would ban union contracts that require non-union employees pay fees for representation. Supporters say it will bring more jobs to Indiana. Opponents say it's nothing more than a union-busting bill that will create lower wages, health benefits, and worsen safety conditions. And with Democrats doing their best to stall it again, House Speaker Brian Bosma says this new session smacks of the movie Groundhog Day.
We will do our very best to encourage them to do what is right, which is to show up at work and do what they were elected to do. Even if you disagree with what you think the result might be, Democracy is about participating, not going on strike.
But Republicans have some added leverage this time. An anti-bolting statute was passed last session, and daily $1,000 fines could be assessed on members absent 3 or more days straight without excuse. Bauer acknowledges the difficulty the threat of fines puts on his caucus.
And we know we can't stay out indefinitely, but we did need to slow the process down, which we've succeeded in doing.
Over the weekend, Democrats held public meetings around the state. And Monday, House Democrats returned to the floor, allowing the chamber to finally conduct business. But the legislative ceasefire didn't last long. Tuesday morning, Right to Work passed a House committee along party lines. The committee chairman didn't allow more public testimony or amendments to be heard, and House Democrats left the floor again. Whether they come in for session each day is in a constant state of flux. Brian Vargas teaches political science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He says the idea that Bauer keeps stressing is that more time will allow the public to be educated and make their voices heard. But he's not seeing any signs of that.
The hearings they had around the state did not generate that much coverage. And I don't know that they were attended by anybody but union members who were already involved.
Vargas says hoping public opinion will sway enough Republicans to defeat the measure is the equivalent of a Hail Mary pass. And even though Pat Bauer represents South Bend, home to the Fighting Irish, this legislative game appears to be in the final quarter. And it looks like there's little to stop Right to Work from becoming law in the coming weeks. For NPR News, I'm Brandon Smith from Indianapolis.
Since the collapse of the domestic steel industry, blue-collar workers in the mountain towns near the border of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio have been struggling to find jobs. Last June, Shell Oil Company announced it would build a huge petrochemical refinery somewhere in that Appalachian region. The plant, known in the industry as a cracker, could bring billions of investment dollars and thousands of jobs. Mari Saito of member station WCPN reports.
In Wheeling, West Virginia, the Spartan headquarters for the Upper Ohio River Valley Trade Council was built in 1966 when the steel industry reigned supreme. But unemployment soared when the mills started shedding workers. Things are about to change, though, for Tom Gray, who sits in the council hall as the head of the 6,000-member affiliation of unions representing local construction workers. All anyone wants to know is where Shell might build an ethane cracker.
There's a tremendous work ethic in this valley. People like that, they're struggling. There's a lot of displaced workers that could work right here if we can get this cracker.
A cracker is industry lingo for a plant that takes oil and gas and breaks them up into smaller molecules. An ethane cracker creates ethylene, a compound used in plastic. There's a lot more ethane in Appalachia these days thanks to controversial drilling techniques known as fracking. Beverly Saylor is a geologist at Case Western Reserve University. She says it's been a while since companies looked to build new crackers in the U.S.
Plastic was made overseas, and that's because there wasn't enough natural gas. But now with all the shale gas development, the price has come down on that, and so it's now worth it.
Construction of a cracker facility could cost several billion dollars and employ as many as 10,000 construction workers at its peak. Once up and running, a world-class refinery could spread over several hundred acres and possibly employ up to 1,000 people. And that doesn't even count the jobs for likely spin-off businesses. It's enough to have state officials seeing stars. C. Allen Walker is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Community and Economic Development.
Potentially, it would be the biggest investment made in the Pittsburgh region in economic and industrial development since Andrew Carnegie built U.S. Steel, and we all know how long ago that was. I mean, it's a game changer.
Walker says a cracker would have a huge multiplier effect on jobs in the manufacturing and chemical industries. Ethylene is used in 90% of manufactured goods. Jack Pounds heads the Ohio Chemistry Technology Council and has worked to help bring the cracker to the Buckeye State.
This is a state that will have probably the most competitive global position in terms of raw materials for its chemical industry, and that should help reverse a couple of decades of decline in the industry in the state.
All three states have sent delegations to Shell to pitch locations for the ethane cracker. Details on tax incentive packages are still not being discussed publicly. Scoring the cracker would be a coup for any governor, especially when jobs are such a hot political issue. Keith Burdett is Commerce Secretary for the state of West Virginia. He says in the end, the ethane cracker will provide jobs all throughout Appalachia.
There'll be a lot of hooping and hollering, regardless of where it's picked, whether it's in West Virginia or Pennsylvania or Ohio. We want it built here. The truth of the matter is the sites, they're just so closely grouped together that the impact across state lines will be significant.
Shell is expected to announce its location for the ethane cracker any day now. State officials hope the cracker will take the Marcellus Shale's natural gas industry to the next level, one where gas and oil extracted from the ground can be processed and used by a new generation of businesses in Appalachia. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito.